time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
I'm Paul Daly, here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we're here to discuss the third episode of USA's Colony. This one is called 98 Seconds.
Dang, I didn't even know this one was called 98 Seconds.
They're not very tricky about how they name these.
They really aren't. So right at the get-go, we jump right in with this guy who's pushing a shopping cart. He kind of seems like a homeless man. The only thing that didn't make sense a whole lot to me about that was that previously Schneider had been telling them that there's like no unemployment,
yeah.
Right? And there's no all these. So this guy kind of like acting kind of like a hobo. I really didn't know where we were at. But then right at the bottom of the screen said day 341 of occupation. So now we know we're not even 1 year into this. So great. Mm-hmm. Now we got a time frame.
He is a homeless looking guy who has a very specific destination in mind, rather than just kind of wandering around.
Was that a church or what was that? Mm. What was that building? Could you tell?
I couldn't.
It had these like gates out front, and he kind of went into the basement of the building, but it kind of looked, I don't know, either maybe like a private school or maybe a church, maybe. I'm not
something
really sure.
Something closed.
So definitely and empty for sure.
And all the while, a voiceover is reading off a radio-free.
I put down ham radio, right?
Yeah.
So it seemed like one of those like, I don't even know what. What it reminded me of, honestly, is like a college radio station where you just kind of get like these very amateur stories and what have you.
Well, I think it's supposed to evoke more the, what do they call it, Radio Free Berlin or whatever it was, or Radio Free Britain or Africa. What was the name of it?
I'm not sure. Tell me more about it.
It was radio during the war to inspire the people listening to it to not feel so oppressed and to go and do their best.
So the story was about Tom and his 12-year-old daughter, Fiona, and about how basically that Fiona had gone to school and made a comment very innocently that her mom had been, was it killed or just kidnapped from the occupation. Teachers overheard this and Fiona was expelled, and now Tom was having to deal with Fiona being very upset and sad. No one would talk to her. And he gave a really good pep talk about how anger and sorrow can be turned into action. Definitely, I felt very much like he was trying to say, get yourself out there, people.
And the shot cuts to various, it looks like service type people, maids and
yes.
that kind of line of work. We're listening.
What was it? There was a maid and there was a, who else? I saw a maid in like a fancy house, like I'm going to guess in the green zone. And then what other type of people? Definitely just regular workers.
I put service people.
Yeah, just workers, just normal workers.
They had earbuds in, so they were kind of clandestinely listening to this radio broadcast.
Included near the end of the story that Tom, in his story, planted a bomb
that went off in the Santa Monica Gateway.
So now we know, right?
Now we know a little wider perspective on what went into that bombing.
And why? Before it was like, why is the resistance being such jerks and just blowing up delivery trucks? And now it's like, oh, well, why don't you know a little more about Tom and Fiona and what went on with them?
I wondered if we were talking about two different bombings, because he described the bombing that Tom bombed as coming into L.A. with a military-related convoy or something. If that's true, then he's lying, because the truck that Will was on was just full of stuff.
Well, and I want to go back to why that story could be a lie later, because when we get in deeper into the story and we start to talk about who is located in Santa Monica, we learn some different information.
As the broadcast goes along, it becomes more and more evident that there's a ticking in the background that gets louder and louder. And about halfway through the broadcast, truckloads of red hats start to swarm.
It's clear that they've like locked in on the position of
triangulating, I believe they said.
Triangulating, always
triangulating.
When are we not triangulating, really? So they're triangulating on our storyteller, and they are basically going to just barge right down the door.
Timer goes off. Right before time is up, though, he says,
I am Geronimo, you are Geronimo, we're all Geronimo. I think that the whole point was just that, you know, stop searching for Geronimo Will in a lot of ways, because the concept of Geronimo is the idea that he was the last Apache to stand his ground. And so it's just an idea. It's a concept. Stop getting stuck on this idea of like, has anyone ever seen Geronimo? Which that's how Katie was like. And his story was more like, I am, you are, we all are, you know, have the idea in your heart. Stop being like looking for the person.
One of the key cutaways shows Bram using brand new Sennheiser headphones and recording the broadcast and putting a copy of the broadcast in a box where he's got a whole
that was
run
a very sexy and like as a organized human being who really lusts after storage porn, that was a really sexy suitcase that fit cassette tapes just perfectly. This wasn't just like he threw it in a shoebox. Like he is like making a sincerely well-organized project.
I bet he makes mixtapes second to none.
I can just tell you this. He stores them second to none, okay?
When the Red Hats finally storm wherever it is they are looking for, they get into an empty room where there are just some wires dangling out of a window and something left on the desk. Something that basically says, what? I am Geronimo. Geronimo was here. Something like that.
I doubt it said Geronimo was here. But yes, I think something like, here's the middle finger in the form of words.
We catch up with an exterior shot and Katie and an unidentified woman riding their bikes down the middle of the street.
I just keep calling her short-haired girl.
I think short-haired girl's good enough. Yeah.
I wish I had a name for her, though. It's bugging me.
They're trading a conversation back and forth that seems to have an innuendo about sexual first encounters and other first encounters.
I think there's some sort of mix of first times, whether they be with another human or in some sort of heist.
They get to where they're going and they meet Justin, who I've written down as the armorer. That means he handed out the guns.
Nice.
Yes.
I didn't even know that word. Armorer. I'm going to try to use that this week.
Armorer. You may not find much use for it in what you do.
Mainly because I feel like I'm making some sort of strange sound like armorer. And so I'm going to be like, what's the matter? What's happening over there?
Another familiar face to show up in this little soiree is Broussard.
Good old Broussard.
And he is there to take charge. He is obviously the team leader of whatever this action is going to be.
When is Broussard not the team leader? He always is.
Well, whenever.
Even when he's not, he is. Okay?
Whenever he's with the guy whose office is in the garage, he might.
Glasses.
Yeah,
glasses, man.
He might be second fiddle to that guy.
So they decide that they're going to go ahead and pull on their handkerchiefs a la banditos.
Fantastic, Mr. Fox and the bandit masks.
Beautiful, beautiful. I love it. I always love it when people they do those half-hearted disguises where you're like, really? No one's supposed to recognize you because your nose is covered?
Yeah.
Come on. Like, or with those masks, it's like just the bridge of your nose is covered.
Their particular caper is set up underneath a bridge.
So it looked like that was an area that I guess the...
Provided some cover.
I'm guessing from the drones, right?
So, well, yeah. Yeah.
This is what I'm guessing. So because they kind of have this aerial surveillance going on, I was guessing that...
That's a good idea.
They kind of hid under the bridge there. And plus, I mean, it seems like a blind spot for the truck.
The truck comes whipping around the corner and mows down a guy on a 10-speed. And for a second there, I thought, that guy got the shittiest job out of all of them.
He thought he was like sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
They're like, it's your turn, Kenny. And he was like, no!
The Red Hats jump out of the cab of the truck and they think that they've hit a man, but in fact, they've hit a mannequin who is pushed on a bike in front of their truck.
What did you think about the fact that the Red Hats actually jumped out when they thought they hit a man? What do you feel about that? I don't feel like stormtroopers would have jumped out and been like, oh no, I think we ran over someone. Like, I feel like they would have been like, right,
no.
Like, you're going to want to go in the next gear.
Right. This is going to take a lot of flooring.
Yeah. I mean, I think like, I kind of would have thought it would have been more believable if they jumped out to see if the bike had wrecked anything about the truck. I thought that would have been more believable, but the idea that they were actually worried about the human body under there, didn't that seem a little like, didn't ring true? These are the same guys who grab the guy at the cafe and drag him in there. Like, I just don't know that they would be that caring.
I saw it the other way. I saw that they were still humans and they weren't in it to just randomly run over other citizens. But they don't have long to think about it because the trap is sprung. Broussard and the gang hop out and take over the scene. And Katie starts a clock.
Well, Broussard uses the walkie-talkie to say, we've been, like, hijacked. you know, backup needed at wherever they are. And that's when Katie starts the clock.
Okay.
So clearly they're timing to see how long until something happens. At this point, we're not sure what they're timing.
The two guys in the cab are kind of willing to go along with whatever's happening here as long as they don't get hurt. But then some other red hats jump out of the box of the truck and some shooting starts, wherein Justin the armorer gets tagged. Eventually, all four red hats get put down. Justin is shot badly.
Yeah.
He's, to pull through, he would need a hospital.
Absolutely. And Katie is so thrown by the idea that, you know, someone within their group has been taken down that she kind of loses all semblance of disguise time and just pulls her handkerchief off and starts trying to stick it in the wound.
To confuse things, a bunch of locals show up and start looting the truck.
Yeah. Well, first they're like actually going to try to have a conversation with Broussard about, I don't even know what, trying to split up the goods or what have you. Like, hey, can we get in on this? Like that kind of crap. Broussard's kind of funny because he could have been like, sure, I get, yeah, sure. Like you hold a gun and go hold them off over there or something like that. But like there's definite lines drawn between whether you are vetted and you're in the resistance or we're just not going to accept any hangers on is what I'm trying to say.
No, he threatened to actually shoot whoever made the first move toward touching the truck because that wasn't what they were there for.
They're apparently there for some intel and I'm not really sure what the intel was besides I'm guessing it's the timers, right?
The stopwatches. They needed to see.
So they wanted it. So the first thing that happens is the drones come up and they stop the first stopwatch. Katie's instructed to stop it. That was the amount of seconds it was going to take for the drones to show up. And then once the humans arrive on the scene, like basically backup, if you will, then they stop the second stopwatch. So apparently, and was that 98 seconds?
Yeah.
So that was the whole deal with the title. It's 98 seconds from the time that there's a request for backup and when the backup shows up. So they needed that to be able to figure out, I guess, how much could they get done in 98 seconds.
A couple important things happen in that scene. One, Broussard just puts down Justin. That's it. We're not dragging his body around and we're not dealing with this.
What did you think about that? Did you think that there was enough people there within the resistance that they could have realistically taken him back?
I do think that that was needlessly harsh. I mean,
well, another thing that I thought too, and this does come back to bite him in the butt, if you're going to leave the body behind, now this is going to sound really gross and bad, don't you almost got to like shoot his face off or cut his hands off or do something? Because like, isn't it going to be apparent?
I don't think you could do enough of that kind of thing.
To get rid of his face? You don't think you could do anything?
Not quickly enough.
Okay.
For what they...
I am not an armorer, and so I don't know anything.
For what they needed to do, they didn't really have the time for all that. And the second thing that we found out was that the drones are in fact armed.
Yeah, boy, did that shock you or what? So those locals decide to throw caution to the wind with Broussard and decide to just go ahead and start grabbing food out. It was all just food, correct? I don't remember there was anything else.
I think so.
So when those drones came, they just struck those guys down. With what? Like lasers?
It seemed to
have a little bit of blood.
It seemed to have little impact sounds. So it sounded like little projectiles, just very lethal kind of projectiles.
Nice.
And but two drones put down about 20 people in about a second after they decided to shoot.
Those drones are pretty handy. I wish we had those around in the world, don't you?
No.
Well, they're very handy. Come on, Paul. We could have one just around the house.
Yeah, they would get a lot of use.
That wouldn't cause any trouble for anybody. So Katie is like completely appalled by this entire situation. I mean, if you think about it, if they told her, look, here's the job. We're going to basically take over this truck. And we're just going to time how long it takes for people to come, and then we're going to run away. I'm sure that's exactly what they told her.
Well, she was trying to help Justin before Broussard decided.
I said she took her disguise right off and shoved it in his wound.
So she's kind of all bloody from all that.
She really was.
And when she gets back to her house, she wants to take care of that. But she finds the Stepford babysitter / tutor inside working with Gracie.
God, she was a freaky chick, isn't she?
I really
hate her. I don't think I could stand her in our house for like a millisecond. I'd be like, I want a new tutor. She's a creepy dude.
Yeah, somehow they found like an Amish person or something.
I think that's like the uniform bits. Like she was wearing like the little pin on her lapel. Poxy Schneider's wearing the same pin later, and she's wearing what I would consider to be a brownie, like Girl Scout uniform, which is very ominous when an adult woman wears it. So it was creepazoid. But she was just so strange. The way that she talked to Katie was so strange.
Robotic, even.
Absolutely. So Katie has to basically get her little Fanny out from under the stare of the weirdo.
She gets upstairs and wants to clean the blood off. So she gets into the bathroom.
It's kind of like the
shower area.
Doesn't seem, was it a hall bathroom that also kind of hooked up with their bedroom? Is that what it, like a little, almost Jack and Jill kind of doors?
Could be. I didn't get the floor plan, but yeah, that makes sense.
I'm only saying because it seems like later she comes out the other door of coming out to their bedroom. So she goes in there, and in true slap your forehead form, she doesn't lock the door. She's like, I got to get in here and hide. Let me slam the door and make kind of a loud noise, but not take that extra millisecond to just click the lock.
The blood doesn't come off too easily, and Will just comes bumbling around like, hey,
well, she,
looking for you.
He's been calling her since she was in the hallway. So that's what I mean. Like, she knows he's looking. Again, lock the door, yell, I'm having diarrhea. And he would have walked the other way. Okay. But she plays this a whole nother way.
No, the opposite of diarrhea.
She plays the opposite of diarrhea. Right. That's why this isn't a true husband-wife situation. I'm telling you, they'd been together for the 15 or 16 years that Bram has been on the planet. She would have pulled out the I'm having explosive diarrhea, get away from the bathroom. And he would have turned on his heel and headed downstairs and stayed away. But instead, she plays this like they're freaking newlyweds.
Rapid fire sex.
Very awkward, I thought, because like all I wrote down was, okay, so this is super clear to me now, like 100% clear. She only uses sex to control him. That's it. Because the other time when she had sex with him, it was just to control that situation. And same with this. This is like, how can I get him to not ask me any questions? Like I said, you could have gone the diarrhea route, but she opted instead to be like, I'm so upset. Oh, let's just get naked. Okay. Well, I guess that was a more exciting thing to watch on USA than explosive diarrhea. But I just thought it was kind of cray cray.
In the bedroom after, Will is trying to say things like, hey, I'm not complaining about what just went down, but...
No, he actually goes, so that was kind of weird.
Yeah, and what's even weirder is that she doesn't talk to him at all.
No, she acts like a complete robot, staring straight ahead, walking around, doing stuff, and then walking away. Now, here's the thing that I'm like, is that she, you know, uses the sex to shut him up. But, like, she's got, like, no freaking game plan ever, right? Like, ever. I don't know what she thought she was going to come bursting in on the house. Like, she didn't have any reason where she was. She couldn't say anything of, I was taking a bike ride. I was walking. I was walking the dog. I was nothing. She's got nothing. I just burst in the house panting. Meh. Like, mind your business, everybody. And then this whole bathroom thing, she's like, okay, I'm just going to have sex with him. And then when I come out here, I'm just going to act like he's not here at all. And that's going to play perfectly. Like, this is an awesome plan.
He's trying to sort this out when Bo calls.
I put super icy Katie. Oh, my God. But don't you think, okay, here's a funny thing, fans. So when we're watching this, I look at Paul and I'm like, God, what do you think is up with her? Like, how is she like pulling this off where she just has sex with him and then just completely ices him out and doesn't say anything?
And I've kind of abandoned my passionate woman theory.
No, but Paul, you do remember what you said? You're so funny. You were like, I don't understand women. It's a woman. I don't know why she's doing it. I was like, Polly, she's a character written by someone else, probably not even a woman.
No.
And like, what would be the character's motivation to be? I feel like she is the most short-sighted human being.
It's like a classic redirect.
But just, do you not agree that she's like the most short-sighted character like that we've seen at all? She never has a plan. I go back to that first episode where she's like, children, we've got to get out of here quick. And then she just runs around the coffee table like six times and they all walk in like it's over now. Like, that was your effing plan, Katie?
Yeah.
This whole thing, like, I'm going on my big heist. I'm going to take my mask off and shove it in Justin's wound, like leaving behind all kinds of traces of me at this scene and taking my disguise off. And like, I'm just going to burst back into the house where I know the tutor is sitting there because she's been here for a while. What was your plan, Katie?
Next scene is at the high school. The high school class, Bram is in it somewhere, but the picture seems to focus on a girl.
She's like drawing like Space Invader pictures.
Something like that. Because the subject matter of today's class is basically the rules and code of conduct from the occupation that they need the high school students to ingest and learn. The teacher is not exactly the most enthusiastic looking person either.
Well, I feel like he's like exactly in Will's shoes, where the Red Hats were like, here's what you're teaching today. They were working on Pillar 4, the values of the authority. Now, we had to have a moment here because I know we're all trying to figure out who are the people or entities that are doing the occupation. And so Paul and I had like a lengthy conversation about this because the teachings that they were rattling off were all about the morals and the values of the occupiers, basically, and that we're going to all share the same morals and values. And my whole thing was that now I am well behind Paul in his sci-fi watching and reading and everything, but I couldn't come up with one example where an alien race comes into the scene and pleads morals and values and ethics to humans.
There's like a little bit of that in Childhood's End, but
tell us more. What is this?
That's a story where aliens come and set up shop, but they're reasonably benevolent, but they do take over every government. The point of the story is that the human race is about to give birth to a much more evolved version of itself. And at the same time, something terrible is going to happen to the planet. So they need to take those evolved children and go. But the time they spent before the evolved children were around was to kind of get the populace ready to support them. That makes sense?
Okay.
But so they have no use at all for everybody else once they get the evolved children.
And they used morals, values, and ethics to convince the humans?
Stuff like that. Yeah, kind of yes, kind of no. If I recall, it was more like just rules and needing to support the kids.
Rules aren't the same as morals and ethics. Those are laws. And that's like my whole like argument. I don't feel like that we've seen where alien entities come into the scene and that they try to appeal to your heart, to your humanity. They don't do that. And every single time that I've ever seen, and again, I am well behind on my sci-fi watching and reading, but they always seem to come in and they're like, subjugate earthlings, like submit, give in, we're gonna create new rules for you and stuff like that. But they never say like, we have the moral high ground, you are going to adopt our values. It's like all this more just, these are the laws, these are the rules, and we're bigger than you and we could crush you with our thumbs, so that's why you're gonna go along. But I don't know, like I never see Darth Vader say anything like, I'm morally correct. Like, it's not the fight they usually fight. And the only reason why I'm kind of fixated on it is because we don't know what the occupationists are. Are they aliens? Are they something else? And if they are humans, either from the future that are time traveling back, or they are some sort of, I don't know, if say the Russians got to space and now they're sort of acting as aliens, right? Where they just have like a spaceship over us and whatever. Like, I'm just trying to think about how you would get to the argument and you would think that morals and values and ethics are the way you're going to get these people to submit.
It does seem to suggest that they are whoever they are. Well, I was going to go with in it for the long game. Like, if they were there, as Snyder said, to
just take what they want,
take what
leave,
they need and go, then
why would they try to brainwash you, yeah, right?
To that depth.
Right. Because otherwise you just go with, do what we say, do what we say, do what we say. And you just keep doing the propaganda. You keep saying that, you know, the people who are the Red Hats, they're the awesome guys. Don't you want to be an awesome guy? But that's not the same as like trying to get to your core about like who we are and what we believe in and all that stuff. Trying to get you to believe in it. To me, that's like a human trait to try to use that argument. So I don't know. It's cracking it open a little bit to the possibility to me that it could be something other than alien, something other than really like the ETs of the world trying to get us, you know?
I kind of don't want it to be aliens.
I know. I don't really want it to be either. How do you feel about time travel and time travelers? Like, what if they come back from the future and whatever it is they're sucking out of us is because it's something they need in the future and we don't have?
I'd be okay with it as long as it was done in a way I haven't seen before.
You know what? Just like saying that, it makes me think of, like, you know, in Monsters, Inc., how they have to do the scared screams to collect the energy.
Yes.
It kind of feels a little like that when they suck up the stuff out of the land. Like, they're like, we need everyone to be very, very freaked out. Now everyone scream in on the scream floor in the factory, right? It's very crazy. So the teacher calls out to Bram when they're heading out and says, hey, shut the door. And all I could think is, it's always good when the teacher yells out to you, hey, shut the door.
Right. This is just basic cable, folks.
Always creepy. But it turns out that Bram and the Teach have some stuff to talk about.
They have an arrangement.
They've got an arrangement is right.
Bram hands over a copy of the most recent broadcast that the teacher appreciates. And then they start to kibitz about the latest launch, which we can assume is the word that the uninformed are using to represent that event that Will watched at Snyder's balcony, that lifting off of energy, whatever it was, from the ground up to the heavens. And what the teacher was most interested in sharing, though, was that he has been using a small telescope and assembling a larger telescope, and what he has seen through it, he hasn't actually seen what he thinks it is. It's more like he has seen something move in front of stars that he believes to be very big. It would black out a star for a few seconds as it went by.
Right. And I thought it was interesting that Bram was like, you have a telescope? Like, it was the same thing as like having the gun, which is pretty intriguing when you think about it.
It was the same reaction. Yeah.
That actually, for whatever reason, piqued my interest more than almost any other line has, because it made me feel like, wow, they had the thought to collect up the telescopes?
Sounds like it.
That makes me feel like you could see through the windows and it's going to be the Russians.
Back under the bridge, Bo and Will are conducting an investigation with several other cops, and they are attempting a reconstruction of what went down. And they are getting a lot of the high points pretty right with, like, you know, the sequence of events.
It was interesting to me that the truck was actually carrying luxury items because it was heading to the green zone. So that totally made sense to me why those local people weren't just like, I mean, they weren't just getting sacks of rice and stuff. It was probably like the chocolate and champagne and the alcohol and all the things that they couldn't get. So that was kind of like, okay, that makes sense to me why they really rushed it. I had to take note that Bo's shirt looked absolutely like an Atari game. I was going with Space Invaders on that.
There are five bodies covered up, lined up on the side of the road.
Only five? Man, that looked like so many.
Well, maybe they were the ones that were found under the bridge. So there were the four red hats and Justin, who they immediately find to be not a red hat.
Well, the whole point was that Katie had left her handkerchief in his wound. And so it was the only one where anyone had shown any attempt to save their life. So nobody else anyone tried to intervene with, which implied to them or absolutely was conclusive that this person was somebody that the people who did the heist cared about. Mm. So then that let them know. Okay, so again, Katie, you short-sighted Muppet. Why'd you leave your handkerchief? Grrr. Or why Broussard? Like, is this your fur heist? Why don't you turn around and say, everyone has their disguises, right? Like, no one left anything behind, right? She is such a liability for them. Good God.
But the fact that Justin also had a shot to his head meant that someone had put him down and that this wasn't Absolutely. Just some random event. This was something done by people that had a plan.
And didn't want him to talk, obviously.
There's a moment where Will goes and talks with Phyllis, who's waiting in the back of a car, and basically give her enough information so that she can get to work.
Well, Will says, I think this was a planned op that went bad. And she's like, way to go in figuring that out, because check it out. And like, she hands him the dummy head. So apparently he did not know, that part. And so just by looking at the scene, he figured out that it had been a planned op. And so I think she seemed a little impressed. Like she was like, very good. Like you did figure that out without even having this key piece of info. And definitely, once again, just to constantly have a middle finger waving at everyone, they had painted the dummy in the Geronimo
war paint.
War paint. Yes. Like, look, you guys, you just can't, you just always have to have the last word, you resistance.
They've managed to find enough information between the body and whatever Phyllis is able to put together that they go right to Justin's house.
Yeah, they were fast.
And the Red Hats have his parents out on the street with their zip ties, and inside they are tearing the place apart. Classic box cutters on the mattress and everything else that they can try to dig stuff out. Inside, that woman that we met last episode, that is the true believer, Jennifer, is conducting the investigation inside, and Will has to kind of step back to her authority because she seems to be in charge in there.
I really liked that they picked up on, Jennifer picked up a book and said, you know, what teenager reads Joseph Conrad? And if you guys are not familiar with Joseph Conrad, he has some really, really good quotes. He's the author of Heart of Darkness, but he has some really good ones. One, I think, is like particularly thoughtful about this show. The first one is, the belief in a supernatural source of evil is not necessary. Men alone are quite capable of every wickedness. That, to me, just what we were talking about, could it be humans sort of impersonating aliens? The concept that you have to sit here and think that it's a supernatural force that could have come in and take us over? Oh no, other men are just as likely to be as evil to us as a foreign body, basically. And then there's another one called Face It, Always Facing It. That's the only way to get through it. Face it. That was very resistance to me.
But Heart of Darkness isn't really about resistance. It's about a megalomaniac who used to be on your team that went crazy and needs to be stopped. So you, on the team he used to belong to, have to go in and either kill him or bring him in.
So then how do you think that applies? I was just giving some Joseph Conrad quotes. And he also happens to be the author of Heart of Darkness.
I don't have enough characters to pick out who is the megalomaniac yet.
But could it be the person looming over the sky in the sky?
Could
they
be.
Have been a part of the American government and kind of lost their?
Justin would need to be really informed to know that. And he was what'd they say, 19?
I'm not suggesting that Justin knew that. I'm suggesting that perhaps citing the author by the writers might have been giving us some information.
Okay.
They definitely did that during Lost, no?
Yes.
So I'm just suggesting, perhaps. And I don't know. I have no idea. We're only in episode 3. I don't
really
know where
everybody's
going.
That would make it much
more
interesting.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, I really liked, come on, that first one. There's no need to look at supernatural forces. Men are quite capable of being wicked.
Very telling.
Dude, that, I just like it. I like it. And I always like little nuggets like that. That always makes me think harder.
While the men are working on the mattress, they find a pornographic magazine that flies out, and Will like shows it to Jennifer and says, big surprise here. We find a teenager with porno.
And it did kind of embarrass Jennifer for a minute, like she had been kind of a dope. But then she's kind of flapping the pages around and
a cipher falls out. A cipher is a key to a code, which a normal teenager would not have.
Maybe I'm just a baby and I don't hide enough stuff. But if you had what we consider to be sort of contraband, the pornography, would you hide your contraband in the contraband? Or would you hide your contraband like in a Bible? I mean, no, I'm just asking, like, seriously. I mean, don't you usually hide, like, the bottle of liquor inside a piece of literature?
I think you're right. They would need a more creative way than just hiding something bad in something else.
Because if I was his mom and I found it, I would throw it in the trash, right? I'm not saying she would look through it. I'm saying she would probably just throw it in the trash. But either way, you still lost your cipher, right?
Mm.
But she's not going to throw your Bible or your school book or whatever. So hiding your contraband inside contraband, I'm going to say is bad, stupid teenager.
On the way outside, they're saying that the parents are going to now go to the factory, and Will doesn't think that's right. And Jennifer gives this long speech in front of all the neighbors about how this is setting a good example for all of them that will make them all think twice about taking any such action in their own lives.
And while they're doing this little tete-a-tete about whether or not factory destination is appropriate, Broussard shows up. And it seems to me that Will sees Broussard, and Broussard most definitely sees Will.
You know, him and Broussard are starting to to be, to me, sort of a sixth sense sort of relationship. We haven't seen them interact directly yet at all.
Even though supposedly they were previous.
They had some background in common in the past. Is it just that? Yes, they both have a history in common, but does that mean it was together?
It doesn't. I don't know. But I agree with you. Like, I felt like Will kind of acted embarrassed. I thought he saw Broussard. I thought.
He seems to have been kind of chagrined whenever the civilian populace sees him do his job.
That's very true. At any point. So maybe it wasn't Broussard. It was just basically he didn't want to be identified basically as one of them.
Next scene takes up in a makeshift shooting range. It's kind of revealed to us slowly because at first it looks like a shooting range. As they pull back, you start to see painted swim lines on the floor and other things that would make you realize that this is an emptied out public swimming pool. Members that we recognize from the resistance, such as the guy with the glasses, who we now know his name is Quail, as in Dan, and others are trying to sort out just what their exposure was by having Justin and his family get run in. Quail directs Broussard to go and pump Katie for more information. Or if she doesn't have it, then she needs to generate it.
Was it the conversation where he was basically saying like...
No, it wasn't that one. It was. This is just where Broussard mentions that Katie's man was at Justin's house. So obviously Will is in the middle of this investigation.
We meet Katie back at the house and Will is kind of bursting in on the scene. She's like, what are you doing home? And he's like, I just wanted to check in on you. Now, I have to apologize about the previous podcast in which I was kind of poking fun at Charlie's baseball because I admit I misread. I thought it said 3-run walk, which made no damn sense to me and sounds silly completely. But it said 3-run walk off, which meant he hit the winning runs in, basically, and was able to walk off the home team one. I apologize, Charlie, and to your parents for saying that you are not a remarkable child, because clearly that was a superstar move. So, mea culpa.
How this comes up is she has had some time to think of a lie, and she says that she was just upset that morning because when she was prepping the yonk, she came across her memory box, which we know happened days ago, but she says it happened this morning, and she came across Charlie's ball.
Here's a funny thing. Now, Paul and I watch a lot of shows where there's some element of loss, and I do pay attention quite a bit to whether or not I feel like the loss is being handled very authentically. We watch a show called The Leftovers, and we do all of the podcasting for that. And there's a ton of loss on The Leftovers, obviously. And so we have been sort of spoiled to a very realistic, very heart-wrenching version of loss and very authentic. So I was having a little bit of a hard time because I know she was completely trying to tell something, explaining her feelings. But then also I felt like she was trying to be somewhat authentic. I'm sure she's absolutely hurting as a mom. I felt like her line where she says, I never know when it's going to end. I appreciated that for being a very real comment. Paul and I have 3 special needs kids, and our eldest daughter is deaf and blind. And for us, there's moments when we experience loss when it has to do with something that now we're coming to that milestone, whatever it is. You know, everyone else is having their first sleepover or something like that, and she's not. And it makes us have those pauses where you do say, like, I never know when this is going to end, when I'm going to feel like I've accepted everything that this comes with. And so I appreciated that. But for some reason, I guess because I felt like she was playing it for a lie in this case, like she was just doing it, I thought, to cover up her other thing, I felt a little cheated as like an audience member because I felt like they haven't shown me true loss from Will and Katie that I want to see, like authentic, realistic, we're achingly missing our son. That isn't being played for a lie, and it isn't being played. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. I didn't catch it with all that emotion. I just thought it was more the digging, you know, deeper.
So that's the thing. I mean, I think that you're totally right. She was using it to basically as like a low blow on Will so that Will would feel, he would feel.
Not ask a lot more questions about it.
Well, and he wouldn't in any way be defensive about that. He would sort of like, what's the word I want to say?
Well, I think where you're going might be where she did end up, which it disarmed him to the point and made him want to share back.
Yes. And that's what bugs me is that whether it's the show or whether it's, I don't know how to describe this to you, but I feel very much like this show could have a real pulse that beats with this sense of loss and grief and struggle and fighting for your kid that is there as a storyline. Isn't quite there for me.
There's no Nora Durst in this story.
No, but there's just no, like when that happens, when it's going on with Will in that conversation, I don't feel like that there's any audience member that watches that and clutches their heart and is like, oh my God.
Charlie.
I miss Charlie. Are they just playing it too shallow right now?
So far, yeah.
Or, and then of course, to wrap it into this really, I'm just sharing this basically because I know it's going to make you, like you said, disarm him and make him feel like, okay, no, I'm going to share some bad things I'm going through and what I'm struggling with when we know it was only just to pump him for info. Ow, I mean, that hurts in a totally different way than in any way relating to them as parents and specifically as a mother who's experiencing loss.
The way shows like this are made is it will build up to a point where in order for them to continue, something massive is going to have to change or happen, and he's going to have to decide if he can let it go or not, because little tiny lies like this are going to keep building up to either put him in like life and death danger or
well, and
something.
How betrayed would you feel if you could connect the dots back once you are absolutely going to figure out that Katie is on the other side? Once you can put the dots together and realize that she played the sorrow and loss of your son, your joint child, to get you to tell information, like how much more betrayed do you feel? Because it's not just that you were kind of going behind my back, but you used our kid and our loss of our kid to pump me for information. Like you're kind of disgusting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is painful to me. So Will absolutely spills his guts, tells everything about Justin, how awful it was that this other family lost their child. And then as an extra blow, now they're going to the factory, though I think that's kind of beside the fact at that point, really. And he said, I'm responsible for that. And I think taking that amount on his shoulders, first of all, I think that's going to destroy this man because obviously there was a million other people that were there. I think Beau would have figured it out if he so chose to. And that's kind of the cool thing about Beau. He might have just kept his mouth shut because he's too old for this shit. We all know. We already know. I don't know. He did say a really kind word and he said, you know, whatever you're going through, we're going through together. He says, just talk to me. And Katie kills me because instead of giving him anything back, she says, I love you. And it's like it shuts down the conversation. He's like, I guess I love you too. But like he just spilled his guts and was like, talk to me. Like that was the give and take. And all I wrote down is like, I don't like how she uses sex or love as like a way to just keep shutting him down and controlling him. Like, it's really yucky.
And she leaves.
And then she just, that's Katie's go-to move. Like, and I'm out. See you later.
Where does she need to get to so badly? Well, the park. It's not weird at all to have all of these single adults having their little rendezvous in the park without children around.
I thought it was so odd. I mean, at least wouldn't you have some sort of front? Like, at least have her bring the dog. So she kind of seems like she's walking the dog. And, like, maybe the Broussard or Quail or whomever also has a dog so that there's, like, some normalcy. Why in the middle of the day in a park where, again, remember, people, there's no unemployment. That means everyone has a job. And they're all just walking around. And at times the short-haired lady, she'll like walk one direction, turn on her heel and walk the other direction. And then keep doing that. Like, oh, that's very natural. If I was at the park and I looked around and saw this, I'd be like, I'm getting the hell out of here. I think there's a drug deal going on. I don't know what is going on. They're just wandering the park.
Broussard is there waiting for her, but before Katie can get there, the short-haired woman from the bike ride kind of catches her between some large toys of some kind.
Like rocks or something.
Yeah, and Katie breaks down with her, and the short-haired woman confides that she felt the same way. She just kind of had to get through it, basically.
Yeah, and like, P.S., in like a moment where I'm going to just make you feel like that much worse, the dreams are going to really suck too. So, but guess what, Paul? She's going to get used to it.
Yeah.
Because that's what we all want, to get used to being weirdos.
She goes over to Broussard, and she is mostly offended with the way he handled Justin. He has to cover that ground first before she'll sit down and talk to him about anything else.
I kind of liked what Broussard said. It actually did make me feel better about Justin when he said, you know, we have a rule. No one gets taken. No one gets tortured. That actually made me feel better, like that he really was saving Justin from a worse fate.
Yeah.
By doing that, I'm still not convinced that they couldn't have tried to take him back. But I guess they just don't have the resources. Like, they couldn't extract a bullet. They don't have antibiotics. They don't have all this stuff. Like, we were pretty sure we know that. So I get it. And I did also like that I kind of, again, a little felt like Broussard was speaking to the audience, but he said, you know, there's nothing romantic. There's nothing pretty about armed combat. I really felt like that was like, for all you people out there who kind of are like, let's go to war, let's just like take out ISIS, blah, blah, like those kinds of things. It's like, there's these moments where I feel like the writers talk directly to us and are like, it's really ugly, you guys. And like, you better really think about what you're saying.
The point of the meeting, though, isn't to defend himself about Justin. It's to tell her that she needs to start producing more will-related information, which is just the first of many of these meetings, yeah. I think.
Oh my gosh, they have so many of those conversations, right? Katie stalks off because that's what Katie does.
Well, because she's got work to do. She's got to go get the yonk ready.
Finally, and she's accepting deliveries, and Madison comes walking in the yonk. And this was interesting to me about how they kind of pick up little nuggets of information. And it did give me a little bit of pause to think, like, how would you be collecting information to try to figure out what does the rest of the world look like? So when they accept delivery for beer from San Francisco, or I'm assuming it's bourbon from Kentucky, they both said, well, I guess the breweries are still functioning in San Francisco. There must be people there.
This is the smoothest exposition they've delivered so far.
Honestly, yes, because they're obviously trying to tell us. So there must be people still alive in Kentucky because they're producing bourbon. So now we kind of have like a little bit of an idea that like the rest of the world was not obliterated. But I agree with you 100%. This was the smoothest. Like, I'm trying to tell you a little bit about what's going on in the world without someone just saying, and as you know, Kentucky and San Francisco still exist. Like, a lot of other exposition has been kind of painful. But Madison teases old Katie about the bathroom rendezvous.
She says, it's a small house.
Things seem to be going well between you and Will.
And they chuckle, and Katie redirects back to Maddie and wants to know if she's going to get back on the horse anytime soon.
Or a horse of any sort.
And Maddie lies. She doesn't want to talk about how things went with George back in the Jeezy.
What happens in the Jeezy, Paul?
I guess it stays in the Jeezy.
Absolutely stays in. Or and apparently she didn't share chocolates and champagne with anybody.
Nice.
She kept her spoils under the bed.
Class move,
right?
Maddie.
She's all like, I'm enjoying the roof over my head, and can you babysit Hudson?
Yeah.
But I'm going to enjoy my sex.
I'm going to enjoy the truffles up
upstairs
here
in my room.
Yeah, she just tells her it was too soon.
It's too soon,
it's
Paul.
Too soon.
She's a sensitive. She's got high standards.
It's been 341 days.
She's not just going to hump someone at a party.
It's not 365 days yet.
No. So now we're back at school, and Bram is doing a little, reading. And Pia pops up on the bike and is like, hey, you got your bike? So it was one of those funny times when they go to a building and it has all these kind of boards leaning up against it. They move all the boards, they open the door, and they enter. And what do? Don't close the door. They don't close the door or even move anything back in front of it or do anything to hide where they were. I think that's going to bite their doobies, Paul.
Yeah, they descend down some utility-looking a ladder, you know, built into the side of a...
Kind of like a manhole cover, yeah. I imagine. If you open it up, then there's like a that kind of metal ladder. I think that's based on my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle background. Aren't there those ladders that go up out of the sewers?
Yes, that's right.
That's all I got.
April O'Neil.
Thank you. So we flash back to the
Bowman's house.
Bowman's home. And we have Tutor Lindsay, I put dressed like a brownie, gives an entire speech that is the worst kind of speech you want to hear from someone working in your home. It's a whole spiel about how your secrets are safe with me and anything that happens in this house stays in this house. It has been my experience that anybody who has to assure you that the secret is safe with them is most definitely not to be trusted, because people who are actually going to keep your secret don't freaking have to say that.
She gives Maddie and Katie the heebie-jeebies.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. Blah.
And I tweeted about that also at the time, and I got a pretty good response that all the other viewers out there got a freaky-deaky vibe off the tutor.
Isn't she a little like Hand That Rocks the Cradle?
Yeah, a little bit.
She's a little like, I have your babies. She's really gross.
Go back underground, and we're making our way through the tunnels, and Pia and Bram hear a very loud, ominous sound that can't be explained with any normal sound that you would have heard ever in your life outside of a science fiction attack type movie. At the end of the tunnel, Pedro is there holding his broken ankle.
He's a super not fun pal to find, because he's not like, thank God you guys are here. He's like, the ladder was slippery, you guys. Stupid ladder.
And he's complaining about having brought help and blah, 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 and does the old I'm speaking Spanish in front of the white people kind of thing. He accepts help. But before they get moving, Bram is super interested in this ladder.
So that noise was happening. He says, what is that noise? And she said, it's because we're under the wall. So we realize now that that trek under the tunnel, Pia says, is not. She thinks they haven't found it because it's so deep under the earth. And that the wall is right over them, which means that when they get to the other side, when the noise is no longer happening, that I think is the auditory indicator that we are on the other side of the wall. And he says something like, what's out there, right?
You can tell Bram really wants to poke his head out there, but if he does, they don't show it to us. At the police station, Will is asking everyone about the Rolodex. The Rolodex is the term that they have given to Phyllis's gigantic database of facts on the civilian populace of the colony. And to me, it sounded a lot like they had just collated Facebook.
Yes.
All emails ever sent. And,
yes. And like facial recognition.
Yeah.
Software.
All into one
pictures.
Thing.
Which I guess maybe that comes back down to the why do they take down pictures off that picture board and stuff. Maybe they are playing games with that too, you know. And maybe that's where Sirik gets the, if there's a little mole to bring it back, maybe after it gets in the database, maybe nobody gives a crap where those pictures go. Maybe that's how he snags them.
If they're that organized, then they might.
Just burn the photos, shred them.
They might know Sirik's whole racket. And
well, they certainly found the Bowmans easily.
The people that he's protecting, maybe they just are letting get away with it until they need to call in the favor like they did with the Bowmans.
Phyllis comes out with a little resume for Justin and is like, hey, here's all the things that we have on him. And Bo's like, good work leads to more work. Like, yay, Will.
How do you motivate people when you find people that can do the work? Your instinct is to give them more work. But that's not a very good incentive for doing good work, which Bo apparently figured out about 20 years ago, minimum.
Exactly. So Jennifer is real quick to grab up the information sheet and call dibs on where she wants to go and sends Bo and Wilbert to the community center.
Outside the community center, Will asks Bo a little bit more about the database, and he is forever curious if anyone that Bo knows about has ever seen what he calls the wraps. So this is another time that we've heard this term wraps, and we don't know what the acronym stands for exactly yet, but they do seem to be referring to either the invaders or the invasion. But whatever it is, it's tied up in that. And again, no one has seen anything about the wraps.
I think ours can stand for Russians.
Russians?
Yeah.
All right. Inside, they start looking around, the lights are off, and we definitely recognize that this is the pool slash shooting range that we had seen Quail and Broussard in earlier.
All I could think was, busted.
They find some, like a sheet of what Will identifies as soundproofing material. And when he pulled it off, I was wondering, what is that for? I mean, to soundproof a building, an Olympic-sized pool, and you pull back this sheet that's like a queen-size bed, and it's like, oh yeah, this is the soundproofing material.
Was it like mattress?
That wouldn't. It was dark. I didn't see. But it wouldn't have done anything. So they would have needed a lot more than that one
Maybe
sheet.
Maybe they're just banking on that we don't know jack about soundproofing, which we kind of don't.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe it was very effective soundproofing.
Maybe. They don't get long to look at it because they start getting shot at right away. Bo gets on the horn and is like, we're in trouble. But Will just goes and chases the bad guys.
Bo goes, son of a bitch, which is code for, I'm too old for this shit.
I appreciated that a lot. I was kind of thinking maybe, just maybe, given that that was Sawyer's tagline from Lost, maybe he'll never say son of a bitch in the show, but maybe it will get said around
him.
That
would be so funny. They make it where like every other character goes, son of a bitch.
That would actually be kind of a nice little Easter egg, which Carlton admitted that there might be some Lost Easter eggs here and there.
So one of the Easter eggs I heard was that they played Patsy Cline, which is Kate's songs from Lost. They play Patsy Cline in this.
Interesting. So be on the lookout, Losties.
Even though Will did not track down the shooter, when he comes back, Bo's like, looky, looky here. Turns out he found a gigantic cache of weapons.
Cut over to Pia's house, and they're bringing in poor Gimpy Pedro.
Oh, Pedro. You're really a liability now.
Yeah, well, they show his leg, and it is definitely broken.
Dude, like, it's gnarled.
You know, broken the skin type broken.
How are they going to get that fixed?
In the new economy, maybe you can't.
So the big takeaway from this Pia, Brom, Pedro returning to the house part for me was that Pia was explaining that her family didn't have enough supplies. And so the whole point of them going through this tunnel, popping out the other side, they were making these supply runs. Brom said, what about the people, you know, on the other side? And Pia says, there's no other people on the other side. That part was a little jarring because that really kind of messed up our original theory that this was just like a honeycomb situation where the walls were blocking people off, but that Santa Monica must be functioning the same as LA.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like, no, that's not how it's going down.
And now we have this third factor in the house. We didn't know where Brom was going to end up, whether he was going to take up with the resistance and Mom or somehow need to play along with Dad. But now he's like a third faction that he may also have his own motivations to want to go to Santa Monica. And now he knows a way to do it.
No joke. I mean, like, what if he's the one that successfully gets Charlie back in all this shenanigans? Think about it. But then how about this? Charlie's supposed to be in Santa Monica and there's no people. So this whole time, Will's like trying to ride the delivery truck in with Spider to get to Santa Monica. And P.S., there's no people in Santa Monica, says
right.
Pia. So, yeah, this was kind of a big piece of the puzzle in terms of Charlie, getting to Charlie, where the hell is Charlie?
It opened up a new section of the puzzle that we didn't know existed.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
And plus, now Pedro's got a gimpy leg.
No, Pedro. And Brom is going to have to be Pia's partner in supply runs.
At an impromptu outdoor meeting, Quail and Broussard are having a meeting. Quail is about done with Will. I think that this was phrased in a pretty dramatic way, given that Will's employ with Homeland Security is only a couple days old.
Yeah, but he's done so much. I mean, he exposed Justin. He immediately found that Andy guy. I mean, he's done so much in like 3 days. He's like Jack Bauer, man. He seems to be like just all over the place.
But Jennifer could have wound up at the pool, too.
Quill makes it real cut and dry. He tells Broussard, Katie's intel must outweigh the damage that Will is doing. That's it. That's the bottom line. We can make a tattoo on that. That's exactly what it is.
Which is pretty much what we foresaw in the first episode, was that she was going to have to try to manage a way to keep Will alive.
The worst is that I don't feel...
If that's her interest.
I don't feel like they're working together or anything like that at this point. I totally don't. But if she had just somehow come clean in some form or fashion with him, then he could know to just go the Beau route and just have done surveillance on Andy for a week, you know, and then like real slow, like find him. And then when the whole Justin thing comes about, maybe, you know, don't find that handkerchief or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, if only they had like a little bit of trust in one another, that a little bit more could actually be happening for the good for both of them.
That's interesting. You know, the first episode sheds a little light on the fact that they may be existing in a sort of get along to, how do you say it? Go along to get along kind of existence, where they're not really probing deeper into whatever in their relationship is not working, like the Charlie stuff.
I could go a little both ways on that. Most families that lose a child many, many times, and I don't know statistics off the top of my head, the couple breaks up, they divorce, because the pain of losing a child and sort of having to deal with one another and in each other's loss is so great that they can't stay together anymore. So we got a little bit of friction at the very beginning there about sort of like, whose fault was it? Should Will have gone and picked him up? Who did what to who now, to why Charlie was away from them?
Mm-hmm.
So given that, I felt like they're struggling through it, you know?
And the relationship right now is at a weak point.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
The particular damage that Will has caused in his latest caper was relieving the resistance of half of their arsenal.
That's some serious damage, huh?
I would imagine, since there's not a lot of weapons available. And because we can assume that whoever the Raps are, they came and got them. So this is the amount of weapons that the Resistance could get a hold of that
in almost a year
had already been hidden away. So it's not like you're going to come across another half of your arsenal.
Right.
It's opening night for the Yonk. What better place for Broussard and Katie to hold a conversation about what they're doing right out in the open than amongst a drinking bunch of people?
I put that they were playing some Zydeco music. It was some hot stuff. Yeah, I totally agree that it was so unusual that they didn't even go speak in a corner or anything. They just spoke right at the bar. And, you know, it was really, really clear that Will was either going to be an asset or a hazard. And that was it. And when Katie was kind of like, Broussard's like, don't act surprised. Like, what are you even, I mean, what?
Right.
This is news to you that your husband wasn't going to be allowed to go like running amok amongst our business? And like, you're like, I never.
So this is another occasion where Broussard is right in front of Will, because Will and Kate are both serving drinks behind the bar.
He doesn't say like, hey, Broussard, what up, man?
No,
nothing.
No
like that.
Interaction at all.
So weird, though. Do you think that really Broussard and Katie had some other relationship?
It could be.
Could there have been an affair, Paul?
It could be. Well, the point
of... I'm just saying that Madison and Katie seem to go for men that look kind of similar. George and Broussard could be brothers. They might be brothers.
I'm sure in some way they are. So the point of the scene, though, is that Katie definitely gets the point.
Yeah.
As outlined by Quayle and delivered by Broussard.
So in the middle of their Zydeco fun,
Beau comes in.
Also bebops in.
New shirt.
Yeah. Sexy, though. He totally busts some balls with Will and Katie. And it was kind of cute. I liked their little back and forth. I thought it was believable.
It was. And was this the first time that Beau was meeting Katie, and he was being very complimentary and silly with her? And before they can get too far into their repartee, Red Hats come in. So this is like,
seriously, Killjoys? Boo.
But then Proxy Snyder comes in and delivers a short speech. And the response given by the crowd was, shall we say, unenthusiastic.
Right. For sure. So Katie's kind of like, you know, what is going on here? Like, what? And Will's like, what's your stake in all this? Like, what's your deal? And I thought Snyder gave like a pretty good response to all this, you know, that basically his idea is that he felt like he could get more flies with honey than vinegar. And so he wanted to, you know, handle his area with a softer hand, you know, try to have this, the recreation for people, try to make people feel more comfortable. I think that he is banking on the idea that this is all short-lived. I believe that he believes that as soon as these entities get what they need, that they will leave them alone. Do you buy that? Do you think Schneider has the idea that this is going to get worse and they're all going to end up being at the factory?
I can go along with the believing that he believes, because that would make him a more useful asset for the management. You know, if he was a true believer in what he was doing, then you see that with like Jennifer and the other true believers to the cause, that they really work that much harder at trying to accomplish their goals.
Peace and everything. Yeah, for sure. And I think Schneider has like an even a little bit even different take than Jennifer. Jennifer seemed to believe in the occupation and like what was going on there. Schneider, to me, it was like they all had to do what they needed to do to get to the end of this peacefully, quietly, as comfortably as possible. And he didn't seem like he was like out there to make it harder on anybody or to be any more brutal than he had to be. Because, you know, we've seen plenty of science fiction things where someone given the power that Schneider has, he could have come in there and basically slapped heads and drank out of other people's beers and, right? You've seen movies where it's like that, right?
Sure.
Where, yes. You know, he's like slapping stuff out of people's hands just because he could be a wicked bad bully if he wanted to be. So I do appreciate that he kind of is coming off with a little bit different tact and trying to be a little bit more, you know, like I said, if you could try to have a softer hand here and try to make it a little easier on everybody, maybe we can just all get along and get through this.
Well, and he shows some appreciation for that people that don't have things to look forward to lose a lot of drive.
Yes, yes. And which is very fair and true.
It's a truth that we hold up in our own house.
Absolutely. We have stuff on the calendar that everybody's working towards.
And so we could appreciate that perspective.
Absolutely. So after Schneider and Katie kind of have this back and forth, and I guess Will's sort of around there too.
She takes off for the back room.
She's really pretty upset. Will tries to play it cool and just continue to serve. But eventually he decides he just needs to go back there. And so he talks to her.
She freaks out.
Yeah. She, you know, I think that realizing that she was perhaps being, I mean, everyone knows everyone's being used by someone else. But kind of realizing that her job was to kind of pacify the crowd, I think that framing it like that, which is kind of what Schneider was saying to her, like, we need to have this place open to make everybody feel accepting of this situation, goes exactly against her whole thing about being in the resistance. Like, no, you should be fighting back and fighting back. So by day, she's kind of getting people drunk, you know, and getting them to just be like, this isn't so bad. And on the flip side of her life, she's like fighting and fighting and fighting to get people to continue to resist. So I could see where she's having this massive conflict right now.
Will, since he only knows the half of it,
right?
He can only reassure her about what he knows, and that is his involvement in her life. He says a lot of stuff, but the basic idea is that he's got a plan. He's just got to get a little deeper in to figure out how to move forward, but he does want to move forward with his own agenda. And his agenda is not straight, flat out collaboration. It is collaboration for his own purpose.
And I appreciated that basically, like, the whole reason why he was in the system and he has to convince her to look at it like this is that the longer I'm in the system, I figure out how the system works and then I can make the system work for us. And that was like, okay, perfect. If I was in the situation, that's exactly what I would want you to say is like, I'm only here to figure it out. And as soon as I figure it out, I'm going to make it work for us instead of feeling like I'm harming people like us.
Which she can go along with.
Absolutely. I want to go back for a second because when Broussard sits down to have his drink, he asks if it's on the house and Katie's like, nope. And he pulls out money, appeared to be regular paper money. And I was a little bit confused because, to be honest, I don't really get how their economy works.
Yeah.
We know they use credits to get food, right?
The coupons, yeah.
And so, and after, I mean, I don't know how long, I am assuming people are, if they're going to work, are they getting paid? And And how is this all working? Because it seems to me like if Broussard is just giving her paper money, like dollar bills, and dollar bills don't mean jack, you can't turn around and use those dollar bills to go buy anything because right. It's all a trade economy.
And there's no government backing up the money.
So I'm kind of confused. Does that mean that basically Snyder okayed for them to get supplies, meaning alcohol and whatever else they need to run the yonk? And then they're like giving out the alcohol, and then are people paying? And then once they pay, is this just the same as like when I play with the kids and they give me grocery money? You know, that's like paper Monopoly money. And I'm like, thank you. And here's your change. Like, is it all pretend? Because like, if the money isn't worth anything. Like when I mentioned this to you, you were like, they haven't filled out the economy at all. Like, we don't understand how this system works at all. Like, why do families all seem to live together in one home? Because we've seen Pedro's family, they were all in like that one apartment and stuff. Like, why have they shoved people together in homes? How does this all work? It's just confusing, right? Like, what is the situation? I hope that they explain it. I don't know why I need to know that, but it just kind of... It's
because you... Like I tried to explain to a listener who wrote in to the show when we were nitpicking on some facet of the show. Since this is a genre show, your brain wants to know what the rules are so that you can be satisfied by when the heroes win the day by following the rules.
Or by finding loopholes.
Well, not exactly. You don't want them to find loopholes because if they do, then it's like a cheat. It's like a deus ex machina sort of problem where you're like, I didn't know that they had an F-15 stored away in the barn that they could just use to fly away. You don't want that kind of ending. You know, the economy helps piece together how complete the occupation really is.
Well, and some of it for me, I need some of the economy information because I need to understand why Pia would have to go on supply runs in under a tunnel under the city. I need to understand that nobody's earning money at said job, but she said that her dad like wasn't making enough money, but I thought money doesn't buy food, credits buy food.
Yeah.
So then, and you have limited rations, like no matter how much money you could be providing them, it's not like you could get 25 boxes or something. Mm-hmm. So I was a little like, I'm trying to piece this together because the economy does feed the motivation. And I want to have the motivation of all of our characters be authentic. I want it to feel like that makes total sense why we're doing it this way or that way. So I feel you. I didn't even know about this listener writing in, but if you're listening, listener, this is my reasoning. My stuff is all based on is the motivation. Does it feel like it's coming from a real place? And it's not just like, why would that character do that? Like, I want them to seem like real people and they have real issues and real needs. And that's why they're acting this way or that way. It's a lot why I don't like Katie playing the sorrow for mother card when I think that she should be authentically sad about Charlie being missing. And so I want her moves to all come from that. And I don't want her to ever twist those moves into being, you know, yucky with her husband and betraying him with information. So I want everything to feel very real. And that's, for me, the mark of a really quality show is when I can say, no, don't you know, because her dad said that thing when she was 12 and that's why she's very motivated.
It's the only way she'll watch a show like this.
It is, because I want these characters to come from a real place. And I want to feel like if they were my friend, that I would be like, oh, you don't even know what she's been through. And that is why Katie has got to do this. You know, like I could defend her. I want to defend all of them.
Is that why you never really cared about Star Trek? Is like the characters and all their things. I mean, it's just sort of like the adventure of the week. And it's not really like there's a real consistency with.
I guess so. I mean, I think that a lot more people have come to stories like Star Trek when they give you the versions when everyone's young and you get to see their parents and you get to see where things came from and why they are who they are now. I think that don't you feel like there's more Trekkies now than there were back in the day, even? Like, don't you feel like there's more of a history and more of a story there and more people are into it?
I do feel like the new movies do present a fuller picture of particularly Kirk, but even in the old TV show, you know, there's an episode where Kirk's brother gets killed. I mean, if you ask most Trekkies, did Kirk have a brother? They'd never know.
Right.
But in fact, not only did he have a brother, but he was killed in an episode.
And I think that that's part of the reasons why we're kind of more of a Star Wars family, because I would say that, you know, hells yeah, we know who's brothers and sisters, and hell yeah, we know. And we know why they're mad at their dad. And we know what happened with this. And when we don't know, it makes us crazy. And all we want are answers about, well, why would he pull that? What? Someone would have known that. I want to understand where the person's coming from and why they feel the way they do. So that's kind of where I'm at, and why I think that this show has tapped into some of the very real things that very normal, average people could tap into. Feeling like you don't have enough for your family, feeling like you might have to go outside the norm to figure out ways to make ends meet, losing a child, feeling grief and worry and about the future of your family and stuff like that. These are all real feelings that have zero to do with an alien occupation.
And I feel like it's showing potential in those areas.
Me too. I want them to stay true to it. When someone's sad about missing Charlie, I want them to actually be sad, not use it to get information out of someone else.
Like, it'd be really interesting if maybe the alcohol chits, or whatever you want to call them, coupons, maybe they're worth food money, food coupons. Maybe it's, you know, some, or maybe you earn them in some certain way, or I don't know, something that would present a conflict for someone that would be like, well, you spend all your coupons at the Yonk, and right, now your baby can't eat this week.
Exactly. And on the flip side, what are Will and Katie sitting on all those credits? Like, is it their credits to have for the work that
it
they do?
It almost seems like it couldn't be.
I know, because it seems like in a state-run facility, nobody gets rich.
Right.
Right? Because that's capitalism. And so that can't happen. In that case, they're kind of just slaves. Like, Katie and Will are just slaves to the situation, which really bums me out. And I don't know how you go in there and play Zydeco music and be like, who wants another, when you are just...
Yeah, held at the point of a gun.
Yeah, literally, right? I mean, it's harsh.
I'm listening to Atlas Shrugged, people. So they bring up the point of the gun a lot in that book.
I love it.
Anyhow, Bo and Will.
So Bo and Will, I loved that they gave Bo a backstory, and I love the way he told his backstory. At first, they were sort of discussing this concept that we kind of touched on earlier about Jennifer and what are her motivations. Bo was kind of questioning, like, do you really honestly believe she could be a leak? Because, you know, let me just tell you, like, she's a true believer.
But I think it still puts her on the radar.
I think it does too. Although I mean, would you be shocked to find out that she was in the resistance? I wouldn't be, because she volunteered and everything. And so some part of me is like,
I expect someone we've met to be in the resistance.
I think so too, that we just don't know yet.
And I was pulling for Captain La Garza myself.
Okay.
Because that would be a pretty cool last second, you know, La Garza's got his weapon pulled on you, and then he decides, now's the time I have to come out. I have to come out of hiding and help Will get out of this jam, or, you know, something to that effect. Bo's backstory, in short, is that he was a San Francisco police officer who had retired to a cabin out in the woods. And he was happy as a clam, living the solitary lifestyle, until one day his dishwasher broke and he needed to come to L.A. to get it fixed. And it was that day that the walls came down. And that's how they caught him, basically, and put him to work for Homeland Security. And Will is just tickled that Bo is now having to be his partner because his dishwasher broke its O-ring when it did.
And the first thing that I wrote down when they finished the story was the absurdity of life. That's what I wrote down. Like, it's so absurd. The series of events that can land you in one place or another that completely changes your entire life comes off so crazy. So just because I wrote that down, it made me look up the word absurd, and it made me look up the concept of absurdity. And it's interesting, because there is a lot that comes out right around this time frame that we're talking about. So it was actually the aftermath of World War II that provided the social environment that actually stimulated this concept of the absurdist viewpoint. And it allowed for the popular development, especially in the devastated country of France. So this whole concept, and it was very popular, you know, it came out, this whole concept of like, you know, the Paul, you're familiar with the story of Sisyphus, right?
I know the point, which is that he's forever condemned to push a rock up one side of the hill, watch it roll down the other side, and then go down to that side and push it back up and do it again.
So it's, so there's so much to that when you think about Bo and you think about the idea that it's like he thought about this lifestyle and he thought about, you know, being retired and he built this house all to himself to just go into a situation for one day that he thought he was just going to go get tacos and a part for his dishwasher, and the wall comes down and he is forever a police officer now. Like, talk about, like, you push it up to the top of the hill, you watch it roll down, you build your house, you build your life, and here you are pushing the damn rock back up the hill. And I thought it was so interesting to me that my gut reaction was to think, this is so absurd to get into this, to this situation. And then the fact that that exact entire philosophy became popular right after World War II in France was like, oh my God.
cannot be a coincidence.
That's crazy. And honestly, I don't know anything about World War II in France right after. And I certainly didn't know that there was a philosophy of the absurdity of life. But if you think about the French and you think about some of the things they do in their entertainment, would the word absurd come to mind?
It definitely would.
Paul and I were at a Cirque du Soleil thing, and there was a gigantic fat baby man who all he did was these absurd things, and the whole thing was like almost painful to watch because you're like, this is ridiculous to the point of being uncomfortable. And that's kind of, if you think about Bo's situation, it was ridiculous to the point of being uncomfortable. You almost couldn't laugh about it because it was so like, why that day? Why did it have to happen just like that? And now trapped forever. Like, and that's what that stupid fat baby, it almost got you to the point of being like, I just want to leave. This is so uncomfortable. There's something about that type of entertainment and that type of just putting people in these situations where it just makes you so, like, gives you the heebie-jeebies that one time you turn the wrong way. And in our show, The Leftovers, the lady says, I wasn't even supposed to be here. I'm lost, and that's why I hit this deer, and that's what landed me here, and that's what, you know, those were the series of events. It's all, like, you're all one wrong turn into, like, a whole different situation. So I really thought that that gave me a lot to think about, and I felt like this episode did give us some good nuggets of information. I'm really excited about Bram and finding out exactly how this is all going to roll. I'm really excited about your idea of, like, having this, like, sort of this, I really thought it was a fork in the road, and it turns out there's, like, another tine in the middle there of, like, what if you don't work for the resistance and you don't work for the occupation, but you do this other thing, like, trying to be prosperous within the occupation colony without being like a resistor, but you still need to have like a quality of life. And Bram's kind of played that role this whole time, you know, with the trading of the oranges and everything. Mm-hmm. Like we talked about, like he seemed to be like sort of working sort of within the system somewhat. I mean, I know going out and getting stuff outside the wall, but it's not like they stay outside the wall and run away. Like that would be against the rules, but just collecting supplies and bringing them back actually doesn't seem that bad. It's a little Robin Hood-ish. If they ran away, that would be like, oh, you're bad people and you escaped. But they just get supplies and bring them back. That doesn't seem that bad, does it?
Man, it's only the fact that you're leaving someone there, I suppose, that would make you come back unless whatever's out there is just unsurvivable.
That's what I've got to think, is that maybe there's just drones that just zap people left and right over there. That's pretty much all that's there. But we do have one last meeting between Katie and Broussard that I hope was real. I don't know if this conversation, what do you think?
I think that Broussard is not being straight with her.
Okay. So what happens is that Broussard's like, give me information. And Katie just starts to start telling.
And she tells about the Rolodex, the big database in the sky that Phyllis has access to.
Now, this part's interesting because I thought she told about 99.9% of the information that she had. She didn't really stop at like 50%, but at like 99.9, she's like, but hold on, I want to make a deal. Now, he doesn't know it's 99.9%, but we all know she doesn't really have anything else right now at this time, right?
Right.
So she tells Broussard, but I'm only going to tell you information if you swear no harm will ever come to Will. Here's what I'm going to say about this. When Broussard says, you have my word, I kind of do believe that he is giving his word and he does mean it. But unfortunately, the sign of subtext is, but this is a dog-eat-dog situation, so words don't really matter.
Well, the word of a reasonably low-ranking guy like Broussard can only cover a guy so far.
Right. So, and but here's the thing. I mean, I don't even know if Katie knows how far up or not Broussard is. I don't know how many of their levels there are. I don't know how high up Quail is.
If they work like terrorist cells, you never really know because you only know you only know your Quail level guy.
That's true.
And he may know another guy, but it's supposed to be sort of just like a pyramid scheme.
No, you're right. So you only know like one level above you and one level below you.
Yeah. And I bet it's meant to kind of mirror that arrangement because it's effective in terrorist type situations, which the Resistance is basically a terrorist organization.
Yeah, no, it totally is. So I felt for Katie that she is trying to protect Will. Unfortunately, I think it's like, I mean, his protection, like you said, is only kind of as good as his actual word, meaning like.
Unless he knows he needs to suck at his job, then he's just going to go in and do it.
That's the killer. Like, I wish that there was some way, and it would have had to already have happened, in my opinion.
Yes.
Because I feel like that at this point, I don't feel like Katie can go back and say, oh, P.S., by the way, I'm in the Resistance. The only way he could do it, no, I'm being serious. The only way that Katie could do it is if she acted as if she was just now getting into it. And perhaps getting information, perhaps, hey, I have an idea, Will, that just came to me this afternoon. You tell me what's going on and I'll get information to the Resistance and the Resistance will try to, you know, whatever, make their moves in ways that the occupation doesn't hurt them. And see, won't that work out well? Like, it would have to almost be like, there's no way she could be like, I've been in this since before you were in the occupation, you know?
No.
Before you were working with them. So... remember all those weeks that I just came in panting? Well,
remember all that quick, easy sex?
It was all a ruse, Will. Quick, easy sex. You're horrible. So now we're through episode 3. Are you hooked? Do you want to know more? How do you feel? What do you feel about these characters?
We're going to keep watching, but like you were saying about the motivations, they're moving quickly with a lot of plotty sort of stuff. And I'm starting to see, when I think about what went into making Lost great, was this balance of character and action, right? And now having seen The Leftovers, which is not too heavy on action, but
real heavy on character,
but has a deep investment in character.
This is kind of the opposite, right?
I think we're starting to see how Damon, Lindelof, and Carlton balanced each other.
Good call.
Because Lost was well known for having really deep character stories.
Yeah, talk about
that.
I know why that person did that.
Right.
Like, I mean, you really got the nitty gritty down to when there were children almost.
And then, but every episode had some kind of action that took place. Whereas with Leftovers, we have something that happens, but it's not really like a Hurley runs over the bad guy in a van kind of thing.
Very true. The Leftovers is absolutely an emotional investment. And then there are some things that you actually have to kind of put to the side, some questions with your investment in the characters. But then this with Colony, I agree with you. Like, I feel like we're really moving forward with the plot points of the story. And we're not really delving into like, what the heck is the relationship of Will and Katie? Why, you know, would this be happening? Why does Madison even live there? What's going on with Broussard, and who are they? Did they work together? Why do they act like they don't know each other now? How did Katie even get to know Broussard? And,
or even Bram. If we're going to be spending this much time with Bram, we really have no idea why he's doing what he's doing, other than he's a teenager, so maybe teenagers do rebellious things.
Well, but, and a girl. Please, Paul, there's always a girl.
But still, their relationship isn't really defined.
No, they didn't. I don't even think they kissed or anything, did they, when she came and brought the headphones?
I think she might have smooched on him, but it wasn't boyfriend-girlfriend thing.
I think they are boyfriend-girlfriend, but I think they act like they're 12-year-old boyfriend-girlfriends, a little less 15 or 16.
So, note to Carlton, more character, please.
I just want to know more. Yeah, I want to understand more. And I feel like I have to understand more, because the only way that espionage and spy work works for me is if I get the strengths and weaknesses of who's doing what where, you know? So if I get that they were already kind of broken apart as a couple because of the loss of their son, and so they've kind of been walking their own paths for a while now, then maybe I can let go of like a lot of things. I gotta know why Katie is this weird sex person where she just jumps on him to like avoid a conversation. I gotta know if that's rooted in something and if this is a long-term thing. He seems to act like it's like, what is happening? Like, he seems to act like this is some weird business. There's some small things like that that within any couple, if your spouse started acting like that, you'd kind of be like, are you having an affair? Like, what are you doing? Things that would come up. And I think that's things like how Madison said, well, things seem to be going well between you and Will. I know she was trying to say because she heard them, but at the same time, I think that's to also say, because in previous conversations, things weren't going well. And so I'm like, kind of like, okay, I want to understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
rather than read into it.
And no one's checking in on Bram, like at all, right?
That's true.
Like, he's just sitting and reading, and Katie's like wandering the park and everything. Like, nobody's checking in on one another. If I had lost a kid, don't you know I would have a long leash on them, but I would have a leash on them, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'd want to know where everyone was at all times. I am super intrigued by Lindsay the tutor, and I think that she's going to be like a... There's a couple little characters that are out there that are so unknown that really make me be like, ooh, I think that those people are actually going to kind of take this up a notch in terms of like, you thought that was weird, you know,
yeah.
Like, wait till you see what Lindsay's up to, you know, there could be some wickedness in this. So I'm excited. I want to see episode 4. I still can't figure out how season 2 looks like moving forward, because I can't figure out if this couple stays together and we stick with this family. Or if we're going to find out in this season that they are on two sides, then how does this proceed?
Right.
I don't know.
That'd be awesome, actually, if they split up and then tell the story that way.
Ooh, I like that. So season 2 would be like kind of from Will's eyes and kind of from Katie's eyes.
But they're
actually against each other now.
Yeah, outwardly against each other.
I like that. That could be very cool. I like that. I mean, it takes away the element of espionage within the house.
But the stakes of people that are against each other but couldn't ever take it all the way where they would actually kill each other.
Nice.
Would be really interesting.
Very true. Very, very true.
Well, thanks for joining us this week. We've gotten a ton of downloads, and looks like we're picking up people, so that's great. Tell your friends, tell your family.
Tell your dog.
Leave a review if you would.
Please, please do. It's always hard to find us when you're on iTunes, and it always helps if we get some extra reviews. So please get on there and let us know how you're feeling. And we love your feedback. So please go to dailyreview.com or Facebook Daily Review and leave us messages. And we would be so happy to talk back and forth with you and discuss anything that you think we should be paying more attention to. Thanks, you guys. Have an awesome night.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.